I'm Stephanie Overbuck.
I'm Mel Wymore.
And this is Pot of Gold. We are super excited to announce our first ever Pot of Gold live event, a webinar on universal basic income on May 10th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time.
Save May 10th, and we'll be posting registration details to our website, potofgold.world. Also on social media channels at Pot of Gold Podcast on Facebook and Instagram, and Pod of Gold on Twitter. Now, speaking of social media, so much of the information, ideology, and entertainment we consume is filtered through algorithms of social media. Most of us know that we've become more polarized and disconnected, trapped in echo chambers that feed us content tailored to our own tastes. The question remains, how will we break out?
In this episode, we are speaking with Bjarke Kalvin, founder and CEO of a social media platform called Ducklin. Bjarke is on a mission to transform social media to broaden our worldviews and decentralize our data for a more connected, empowered world. Here's Bjarke.
So I'm Bjarke Kalvin. I've been working for most of my career as a journalist in online media and also as an entrepreneur. I've run various startups. And for me, the whole thing started out with a personal fear of getting a narrow worldview if I sort of didn't explore stuff. So it started with the real urge to explore the world. And I was really afraid of just ending up in a 9-to-5 job and not sort of seeing a lot of things. Not that there's anything wrong at all with 9-to-5 jobs, but that was like my worry back when I was young. And then I chose to become a journalist because I saw an opportunity to speak with a lot of different people and travel the world. And then it went from a personal thing to a more communal thing. And I started to see the opportunity of broadening other people's worldview with what I was doing. And then that turned into the realization that where we are right now in humanity is at a place where we can only solve our big obstacles, our big problems through a collective effort and through collective intelligence and collective information. So really what I'm working on now is facilitating in various ways that we can share stuff collectively and come up with solutions collectively.
So what is your project, and how does your project fit into this larger scheme of networked media?
So about a couple of years ago, I started a project called Duckling. It's an app, and the idea was to create an alternative to social media where you had algorithms that would expose you to other viewpoints and so on. And basically, we did all of the things that social media is not doing. And it took us a while to realize that that's probably a bad idea if you're also trying to build it the same way as social media. So we got investments from Silicon Valley. We have great investors. That's, you know, not the problem, but we were trying to take it to the next step and get, you know, bigger investments, which is super hard when you come with a model where you eradicated all the stuff that that addicts people and so on. They're like, yeah, how is this gonna get sticky? So the format is these little Instagram-like stories with texts and images and so on, and you can give them tags, and based on the tags, you can see other subjects and other viewpoints. And it's still working, but we stepped back and we started considering what our next move should be. And the direction we're going in now is actually creating a foundation ownership. So we're gonna remain a commercial company, but we're gonna be owned by a foundation that controls the company. So it can never be sold basically to Facebook, because that was one of the things we were facing, was like people were saying, that's fine, Bjarke, that you have these ideas, but when Mark Zuckerberg comes with a big check, you know, how can we be guaranteed that you don't just sell it? So we're going to make an actual guarantee that that's not going to happen in this way we structure the company. And that's also going to lead us to a different kind of way of fundraising. And then We're going to open source our code. So we'll open up again to a more communal way, hopefully, of building Duckling.
You know, it really struck my chord for me when you talk about narrow worldviews. You know, in the United States, we're seeing very much polarization. And depending on which side of that polarized political system you're on, all the information you get is very much filtered through that lens. So I rarely get information from the full spectrum of what's going on and what people are thinking. How do you see that polarization affecting our ability to create, might you say, collective intelligence?
Yeah, well, I think it's true for the United States as it's true for Europe as well. And, you know, a lot of places in Europe, I think the same mechanics apply because it really goes back to social media. I don't want to sort of accuse social media to be the root of evil for everything, because there's also good sides to it. But it definitely is, you know, creating these echo chambers that polarizes us and actually makes us, yeah, makes our worldview more and more and more narrow instead of the opposite. And
Bianca, I have a question here. Sorry that I interrupt you, but is it when you say social media, isn't it the algorithms within, like how they are applied, that actually create that polarization, that pockets, as you said? Or is it really social media, the concept?
No, it's the algorithms that they tailored because they wanted people to become addicted, because then they can sell us more ads and make more money. And the first place to really start to nail those were YouTube, and they started optimizing. We all know, you know, you see these at the end of a YouTube movie, you see suggestions to new movies, and they started really nailing that, which made people just return and return and return, and made YouTube hugely popular. But it also caused was that we, you know, if you see something that's a little bit radicalized, not much, but just a little bit to the left or the right or religious or some other kind of radicalization, you start to see more and more and more and more, and it gets more and more and more radical. And in the end, you think everybody agrees with this worldview. And so New York Times actually has a great podcast with this called The Rabbit Hole. There's an engineer, one of the original ones, a French guy that engineered this thing for YouTube. And he realized this. And then he went to his managers and said, you know, we have a problem here. And I've actually changed the algorithm. So now it's suggesting opposite views. And they weren't interested in that at all because it doesn't create addiction.
Amazing.
And so what happened after that? After YouTube started, how, you know, it seems like every social media outlet moves in that direction. Is there any hope in social media for that to change?
I'm not sure that social media is ever going to change. I think they've set down a direction where there's so much money involved and so many interests that that's just impossible to change. But I think what we can do still is create alternatives. And I also think it's not about, you know, waging war on social media and eradicating social media. It's about creating balance. So if we look at the traditional media world, in the beginning, you had the Yellow Press in the US, which was run by Joseph Pulitzer and Hearst, and these people that we kind of celebrate now as drivers of the original journalism. But they started out with something super populist, you know, based on all kinds of gossip and rumors. And it was by most standards, really horrible tabloid newspapers with very narrow worldviews. And then, you know, as time went on, we matured and we got the New York Times and the Guardians and all these places that balanced things out. So, you know, we all need a little gossip and entertainment once in a while, but we can't only live off that. So I think what we need is to balance things out.
I mean, I don't, before we come to Eurovision, which I'm really interested in, you know, and how we're gonna how to move forward in this, because it seems I've seen this film about social media the other day, and it was a documentary, and there were a couple of interviews of a couple of founders in Silicon Valley of, you know, various media companies, and the most striking thing to me was that their kids are not allowed to use social media. And I was like, wow, you know, if their kids are not allowed, why are we allowing our kids to use social media, you know, in to the extent as we are? And then all these dark statistics come up with how a suicide rate has increased in teenage girls from, I think, 12 to 16 or something. Crazy, you know. So, yeah, it's like we let the genie out of the bottle. And now what do we do? Put it back in? Or when you say balance and alternatives, how does it look like?
Yeah, well, I think the balance, the first question we have to start asking ourselves, and this applies to media, it applies to a lot of other tech stuff, is how can we help, or how can we make this serve humans? How can we make it help us? Technology can lean two ways, and it always does. So we invented, you know, we found out how to splice the atom, and it's led to atom bombs, but it's also led to amazing quantum physics, you know, which run computers and stuff. So there's always these two ways, but I think we have to awaken and, you know, bring ourselves out of this sort of mad way of using technology for the benefit of very few people, and then start to figure out how can we make it benefit all of us. So that's the first question to ask. And then once you start asking those questions, you know, you'll see solutions to networked media that will look quite different, I think, from social media. So, you know, some of the mechanics will be the same, but instead of having algorithms that feed us the same things all the time, that puts us in echo chambers, maybe we'll have algorithm that tells us, hey, Bjarke, you've been looking quite a lot at, you know, Trump tweets lately. Maybe you should check out some Al Gore tweets or whatever, Obama tweets. So stuff that balances things out. I mean, you know, I don't want to, you know, I'm not more holy than anybody else. So I'm also in a bubble, but just maybe on the other side than Trump. So it would be interesting to balance, you know, things out. Again, I actually tried once to sort of on Facebook befriend a bunch of far right Republican pundits to see just, you know, what was going on, because most of my friends are like environmentalists, left wingers, moderates, and so on. But they never reached my feed because of the algorithms. Like Facebook can see, okay, that's not the sort of guy that Bjarke is, so we're just gonna, you know, keep that stuff out of his feed. So I never, you know, I never see that world, even if I actively try. So I think, so I think the new kind of media is gonna be engineered in a different way. But of course, the common denominator is that we're in the age of networks. So, and that's also one thing that we really need to understand. And I'm also talking to journalists here. I've spent a decade trying to get, you know, the traditional journalists to understand that the age of the printing press is over. And now we're in the age of network media. And this is what social media really got. And this is why they've conquered the world the way they have. But we can use the same mechanics to build something different.
We have had interviews, quite a few, about how looking at distributed networks for example, money, with like a hollow chain with Arthur Brock, and some of these other distributed ideas. But when it comes to media, I think it's a very interesting challenge, because media seems to seep into our identities in a very deep way. Like this polarization, I too have attempted to kind of create a broader worldview and reach across to the other side of culture. And I find that socially, in real life, you know, not just what I'm consuming, but in real life, either it's a very superficial connection, Or it's just a freeze out, right? Like there's zero, you know, there's zero openness to creating relationship across the line for whatever reason. How is it chicken or egg? Is media driving the way we treat each other, or is the way we treat each other driving media? And how deeply can it shift in this, as you say, networked media? Would it be possible a possible outcome just that we have different networks of media for different worldviews? In other words, you know, blockchain over here for the conservatives, blockchain over here for the liberals, no blockchain in between, you know. And how close are those two worlds in terms of our actual ability to bridge?
I guess they would be color-coded. It's like the red blockchain and the blue blockchain.
Yeah, but yeah, so can media really bridge that gap at this point? Or are we evolving just into splintered species?
I think, you know, the question of what sort of come first, is it media that drives our way of thinking, or does our way of thinking drive media, is super interesting. And I don't think it's either or. I do think it's intertwined and it's a push and pull. But I think we do have a step in front of us as humanity, which is about detaching ourselves from these ideas of who we are. I think it's fine to be conservative or left-wing or gay or straight or non-identified with gender and all these labels that we put on ourselves. We just can't be identified with it. We can't think, this is me. I am an Obama supporter, or I am a Trump supporter. No, it's something I'm doing at the moment. I'm also a dad, but you know, it's not who I am. At the moment, I'm a dad because I have two small kids. But when they get older and move away, you know, if I was a dad, then I would disappear, but I don't. So I'm something else. So we have to sort of reattach ourselves, detach ourselves from these identities. And I think that will help media to not become so entrenched in different camps. Mm-hmm. I think it comes back to our collective data, which is actually not really even data, it's actually our lives. So right now that's in the hands of quite very few companies. Facebook, Amazon, Google are the main ones sitting on and tracking our every move, basically. And we all know it. Like, you know, I'm probably gonna, after this podcast, I'm probably gonna see you and Stephanie appear in my Facebook feed, you know, because they've listened in.
Just good news, Bjarke, just good news.
And I think, you know, that it actually, it's not so much for me about eradicating sort of the tracking of all of us. The problem is that it's owned by a few corporations, and it's being used to benefit very few people. But I think if that data was owned by all of us, and we had certain rights around it, and all of us could sort of use it to monetize our various projects and so on, it would create a whole new ecosystem and a whole new way of thinking. So I think that's where we need to somehow move ourselves. And there are projects. So Tim Berners-Lee, the father of the web, is, you know, of course, not super happy with how it's turned out. So he launched a new project called Solid. And the idea is to sort of separate the services and the data. So if you think about email was constructed at the start of the internet, at the start of the web. So the way it works is that you can use any email client. You can use Outlook, you can use Apple Mail, and it will just pull in your email. So the email data is separate from the app that you're using to read it. Imagine if social media was like that. So if you could switch from Facebook to another platform, and all of your friends, all of your connections, your photos, everything would follow. That would completely change the way competition in that space works. And it would be more about competing to empower people, possibly. So Tim Berners-Lee is working on the architecture for that. It's actually already out there. It's called Solid. So I think projects like that are super interesting.
Well, what's really interesting for me when you talk about these centralized companies who currently basically hold the data and kind of wall off, you know, data from basically each user, is that they, in a way, have created a fantastic infrastructure and fantastic networks. And so if these networks and infrastructure could actually come into the hands of the commons and serve the common good, so to say, that would be phenomenal, right? That's kind of, is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying.
And so how would that, in your vision, how could that serve in particular communities, in particular marginalized communities?
Generally, for humans, not just marginalized, but also, you know, everybody basically, collective data can help us understand ourselves and understand others. And so I think it can, if we all have access to this, more or less equal access. I mean, it's super complicated to, equality is a very complicated thing. And it's not just about providing the technology and all that, but let's say we actually manage to create equal access to underserved communities and so on. They would start to get a whole other picture of themselves. So it's actually how sort of we construct our world. So Yuval Noah Harari, the Israeli historian, has a really great way of putting it. He says there's three kinds of reality. There's some subjective reality, which is, you know, I have a headache and my doctor looks and scans my head and he can't find anything, but I still think I have a headache. So that's my subjective reality. And then there's objective reality, which is the law of gravity. So if I release something, it's going to drop to the floor. It doesn't matter. You know, my opinion doesn't matter. It's a law of nature. And then there's something he called intersubjective reality. So that's all the, and that's driven by stories. So that's the narratives we make. You know, it's money. It's democracy. It's all these things that most of us take for granted, and we actually think it's an objective truth, but it's not. Money is just a piece of paper, but it has value because we all agree on it through a story. And so when we start to enable people to see these narratives, to see these stories, to see their lives and other people's lives, we actually go back to broadening their worldview. We broaden their worldview. We're broadening their view of themselves. And so, you know, that's going to lead to a different way of living.
Yeah, I actually think it's more than that. It's like lifting a veil, almost like lifting a mystery, right? When you become aware of what the story is behind the construct, then you can realize it's like a raise in consciousness. Really.
Is that, I mean, are we saying that stories are the basic DNA for agreements, for human agreements? I mean, like you take the idea of democracy, which evolved over, you know, many hundreds of years. How do you explain that in terms of a story? I mean, I'm a little bit, I know Duckling is like sharing your story or sharing someone else's personal anecdotes. How does that differ from kind of the evolution of ideas? Or are you basically equating the evolution of ideas to stories or even human agreements?
It ties together in the way that stories are what makes us all move in the same direction when somebody gets a great idea. And that's actually where we set ourselves apart from most other species, even from other species of humans. So Harari, again, has this, which I think is a great hypothesis, that what made Homo sapiens win the battle among humans was that we were able to tell stories to each other around the campfire, and then that would enable us to create communities and eventually very big communities, like huge cities and so on, because we could all agree on a story and march the same directions. And all other species, including other species of humans, weren't able to work together in such large numbers. And that was stories. So I think stories is, you know, tied to ideas. Ideas is the sort of the true north, and stories is what directs us to that true north.
That's a very nice
So
way.
Stories are the organizing catalyst of movement, basically.
Yeah. Is there anything we haven't asked you would really like to share with the listeners or for the listeners?
No, I think we've rounded a lot of good things, and I'm super happy that you wanted to bring me in. I think, you know, you have a format that really just is a catalyst for, you know, making us talk about all these things. And it's really great. I think it's part of also what's missing with media is that, you know, we talk about all the little narrow day-to-day news things, but we need more of the big ideas, the utopias. So thanks a lot for doing this.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I think, oh, that's our dog in the background.
Yeah. She's been really interested in your interview too. I can tell. She's like going around this PC here and the table. I was like, yeah, I want to talk to him too. Okay, no. Sorry, Bjarke.
No, but I actually agree that it's, we, you know, if your next venture can do, you know, more kind of deeper dialogues, I think it's, and have people thinking about collective intelligence, yeah, identifying as more than just their attributes, right? We are a collective identity as well. I think that maybe what you're getting at is how do we develop not just the direction we're going, but our sense of collective identity.
Totally. Because we have a mental concept of it right now, an intellectual concept. I know that I shouldn't fly too much and I should not use too much plastic and all these things. I know that intellectually, and I'm just talking personally, but I'm starting to feel it as well. I'm starting to feel a little bit weird eating meat and stuff. But I think it's just a short little beginning of something. And I think if we all start to move it from an intellectual concept to actually a spiritual concept, then, you know, that's where things really change.
You know, we've met Bjarke, you know, 3-4 years ago, and you know, at the time he had this vision about media, and I didn't quite get it. And it's really evolved, the idea that, you know, media is very, can be very divisive, and because of these algorithms, our cultures have reflected those algorithms.
Right, I think we also have, there has been a lot of going on in a couple of last years. So I guess there is our experience with social media and what's the genie in the bottle which was let out has become clearer, has surfaced. Not just the good stuff, but also the dangers. And a lot of people who were warning were right, right? And I think it's areas you don't want to go there because it's kind of dark-ish. And now it's, I think the good question is like, what are we doing now? This thing is out. Yeah. There is no way we can get it back into the bottle. And do we want to? And that's, I think this is what he's pointing to. You know, we can't get it back in any case.
Yeah, I think he's saying let's create more alternatives, right? Let's create not just these this way, but let's create other algorithms that bring people together.
Right, and use the decentralized web.
Yeah.
Like the real power of the web. The web once was created to exchange knowledge and to connect people and not to compartmentalize. And that's what has happened since. Yeah, there is this huge compartmentalizing of opinions, perspectives, politics, and you name it. But the real invention of the web was a good intention. And then there is the dark web, and then now the whole basic centralization of the web, the commercialization of the web, all these kind of developments which weren't, I truly believe, which weren't planned in the beginning. And now we have a new opportunity, which is blockchain, and which is decentralized ledgers and the decentralization in its totality as a concept, right?
Yeah.
And I think this is where Bjarke is pointing us.
Well, I'm not even sure he's using blockchain. I think he's saying, creating... you know, even if it's centralized, to have it be like a BBC like foundationally driven, not commercially driven, and the fact that people are making their own content. We do have this distributed creation of content. And I think the real core of this message is that the stories we tell, the stories we listen to, the stories we repeat in our minds or put ourselves into is what really creates our experience of culture, of community. You know, we kind of reflect our stories.
Right, but Bianca brings in this nice level of tech.
Right. No, yeah. He does, definitely.
So there is storytelling, which we don't really need an iPhone or any kind of mobile phone for, and not even the internet or decentralized, nothing. You need you and somebody else, and that's important. You actually have to have somebody else because there, otherwise, what's
the
story?
Well, I have many different stories I tell myself, my many different selves.
Right, but it's becoming boring, Mel, after some time, right?
I'm teasing. I'm talking about my split personalities. I mean, we do tell ourselves stories, right? We it's not just each other, but we also make meaning of what occurred, and it defines who we are as people or how we behave in the future, and we can change
all
our
I'm
own
saying
stories.
Is that Bianca brings in the tech factor.
Yeah.
Right? And that is another level. And it's a very interesting level because there is no way we get rid of tech.
Right. And tech has a way of mediating our stories.
Unless the Wi-Fi fails.
No, tech has, yeah, no, it's true that tech has a new way of mediating our stories at scale, right? And so there's a huge power in that. It's not just picking up on individual experiences of story. And, you know, I think he's opening the door to a new world of tech that actually empowers individual stories and connects them to both similar and dissimilar perspectives, which is really cool. Creating a common human experience that works for everyone, you've got to have a story that motivates that, that creates, that inspires that behavior.
We are an independent, listener-supported podcast.
For the price of one latte per month, you can help fuel our work and keep our content untainted by commercial interests.
For more exclusive content, join us on patreon.com or click donate on potofgold.world.
Thanks to our producer, Riley Paul. I'm Mel Wymore.
And I'm Stephanie Overbeck.
Thanks for listening.